happened at a primary school in County Antrim. Matt Steele has more.
It was the last day of term at Carnini Primary School on the outskirts of Ballymena. The boy was attacked in the playground, where it's understood children had queued up to stroke the dog. It's now been put down. The boy's been taken to hospital in Belfast with facial injuries. The Health and Safety Executive is investigating.
Moore's murderer Ian Brady has lost his legal bid to be transferred to a prison. A mental health tribunal has ruled the 75-year-old is mentally insane and must remain at a secure hospital. Nelson Mandela's former wife says that he's showing great improvement, but he is still clinically unwell. He spent nearly 3 weeks in hospital in Pretoria, where he's being treated for a lung infection. Two men accused of killing a soldier, Lee Rigby, will go on trial in November. Michael Abodelagio and Michael Abodewalali are accused of murdering him outside Woolwich Barracks last month. A teenager stabbed 17 times while on holiday in Turkey has been discharged from an intensive care unit. Hospital officials in the result of Marmaris say Dwayne Ward is now stable and is being treated on a normal ward. In sport, Laura Robson is into the third round of Wimbledon, and as her popularity rises, so does her celebrity following. The teenager has been receiving tweets from members of One Direction, and she's been on the receiving end of jealous fans after Harry Styles wished her luck.
I looked at my replies and it was just like thousands of these messages saying, who is she? I was like wetting myself because it was so funny.
And Liam Gallagher's BDI has kicked off Glastonbury 2013. They played on the other stage at Worthy Farm in Somerset this morning. Tonight sees performances from the Rolling Stones. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woollacott. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, King Mervyn's retiring and a new kid's moving onto the block at the City of London. Whilst the BBC and others drone on about his role as Governor of the Bank of Canada, they avoid any mention of his much more important role on the board of the Central Bankers Central Bank in Switzerland. That's the Bank for International Settlements in Basel. He's chairing two groups as part of the BIS, one to stabilise the currencies of the world and the other to draw up policy for the central banks. Neither of those seem to be working. Anyway, the first investigation into the Bank for International Settlements, Carney's employer, Ladom Libor's Tower of Basel, has just been published and it makes for frightening reading. The bank provided a lifeline to Hitler in the 1930s, helping him fund his arms build-up and through the war to provide the Nazis with much-needed foreign exchange. Also, 6 months on, I catch up with a Filton aircraft engineer, John Hart, who's managed to find a farm to carry on his work since he was kicked out of his Filton hangar by the owners BAE Systems when they closed it. And he tells me not everyone has been so lucky. So, have you had enough of shouting at the TV and radio when they talk rubbish? Well, enough of all that. Luke Radowski founded We Are Change, which uses the internet to doorstep the war criminals, bankers and others in the mainstream media fail to do. Plus, Martin Summers will take us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 20 Celsius, fairly cloudy, with some sunny spells for Glastonbury. Highs of 21 degrees Celsius next week, plenty of sunny spells and a small amount of showers. Next weekend, that's the 6th and 7th of July, highs of 23 degrees and sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So this week, I wanted to review the news with Labour's candidate for Mayor of Bristol and one of the most well-known black minority ethnic advocates in the city, Marvin Rees. But Marvin, for his sins, is an employee at Bristol City Council working in health. When he asked the council for permission to speak on the latest developments in the Stephen Lawrence case, with police infiltrators smearing the Lawrence family and the key witness in the case, he explained to me he got a reply from Bristol City Council's Director of Communications, Peter Holt, threatening dismissal from his job if he spoke publicly on the matter. So I contacted Ruth Wilmshurst, Bristol City Council press office, last week, and on Wednesday this week she said she'd email me a statement from Peter Holt on behalf of the council explaining why Labour's former mayor candidate, who came second in last year's election for mayor, was facing the sack for speaking publicly about the Lawrence case, and how it was considered this might impact on his ability to do his job at Bristol City Council. Well, Ruth didn't return that call, nor did I get any statement on email. Interesting that Peter Holt has the resources to threaten to sack Marvin, but not to explain why he's done that to the public who pay his wages as a public servant. So, bearing in mind the police had to defuse a racial incident with EDL supporters threatening to march into Easton last month, 2011's Easter Tesco riots, and a history of street riots between the police and black minority ethnic community in St Paul's, I'm inviting Bristol City Council's Director of Communications, Peter Holt, onto this show next week to explain his decision and how it fits in with the council's stated policy on black minority ethnic community relations next week. So, instead of Marvin Rees, and in no way saying he's second best, we have Labour Councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woollacott, helping us review this week. Hi, Mike, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hiya.
First of all, Mike, your day job is what? You're a councillor, but what are you doing during the day?
During the day, I'm a full-time trade union official with a communication workers union at the big sourcing office out in Filton.
Okay, and what does that involve day-to-day? What are you doing?
That's basically monitoring all the activity that goes on site and dealing with issues as they come up on site, and obviously raising CWU national policy amongst our membership.
Okay, so that's Communication Workers Union, basically postal workers. Just give us an idea of what might come up as part of your daily work that you need to intervene and gets you excited about what's happening, because essentially it's quite a mundane job, I would imagine. You're counting, sorting out letters, putting them into boxes. What sort of stuff comes up that's an industrial issue that the CWU needs to get involved with?
Well, it covers everything from the sort of fairness of overtime allocation to the treatment of people with long-term health conditions and such like, and maintaining some kind of equity within the building, making sure that people aren't walked over and people aren't picked on by the managerial team there.
Does that sort of thing still happen?
Less so, but it's still there under the covers.
Now, there is some, I mean, this is around about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I remember Vince Cables announcing another bid to privatise Royal Mail. Can you tell us what the latest is with that?
Well, the government have passed legislation to enable the sell-off of Royal Mail. It's something that the CWU are actively campaigning against with many other partners. It's something that we feel will bring a detriment in the long term to the service that people provide. It is one of the few sort of jewels in the crown still left in public ownership, and it provides an effective service to the general public, but unfortunately the market wishes to get its piece of meat from it.
Dispatches, which we'll be talking about this week's dispatches a little bit later on, but a couple of months ago had a really interesting documentary about the private mail companies. Can you just tell us about what's the difference between the way Royal Mail deals with mail and the way the private mail companies do?
Well, Royal Mail have a universal service obligation which requires us to collect post and deliver post 6 days a week to every residential address and business address in the country. Our competitors are free from the shackles of that and are able to deliver in a time frame that suits them and obviously is the most economically efficient for them. They are in the process of trying to undercut us at the moment by basically employing people on worse terms and conditions of employment, on 0-hour contracts, not offering reasonable amounts of annual leave, and not allowing people breaks. It's we're sort of in a race to the bottom if we allow this kind of unfair competition to continue.
Well, the dispatches program I mentioned was back in April, and it's called Secrets of Your Missing Mail. This is mostly with courier companies and the various different private competition there is to Royal Mail. But I come back to you. Well, what is the actual difference in the service you're getting? Surely it doesn't really make a lot of difference if it's a Royal Mail employee, a nationalised person, if you want, sorting mail, or whether it's a private business.
Well, it's unusual, actually, because at the end of the day, you do actually pay less, on the whole, for the services Royal Mail provides. And we have a certain degree of integrity within Royal Mail. We have a high level of security through the system. Anybody who's caught in any kind of way misbehaving is dismissed. There's strong security checks all the way through the process. Everything's monitored, and people know that it's safe and secure when you put your post in the Queen's Mail.
So is it really the Queen's mail? Does she actually have anything to do whatsoever with it? I mean, isn't that just a throwback to medieval times, the royal mail?
I would think not. I think it's an absolutely important part of a modern industrial society. We have a situation at the moment where we see a massive expansion of e-commerce in the ability to deliver on what you purchase online has to go to somebody. And I think at the end of the day, Royal Mail provide one of the most effective and cheapest services in the whole of Europe.
One of the things that they showed on this Channel 4 Dispatches programme, for example, was people in these private companies throwing parcels around. I mean, literally from one side of the factory or one side of the floor to the other, maybe 30 or 40 feet. I mean, surely that kind of thing happens at Royal Mail too.
No, we have a much more controlled environment. I mean, obviously, due to the volumes of mail that we deal with, we have to have a very effective pipeline that ensures that the vast majority of mail gets through in intact to the other end.
Well, that's the vast majority. That's not enough, though, is it? Because everybody that's put something in the post expects it to get to the other end. With the minimum of delay, that is to say, you know, if it's first class the next day, second class maybe a couple of days, everything. And it's not good enough, Mike, to say the majority gets through.
When we talk about first and second class, you are talking about a universal service obligation, and this is an obligation that isn't imposed on other operators. Private operators have the freedom to deliver every other day or maybe even twice a week to residential addresses, so there's no legal restriction on that. We are the only organisation that has that fixed statutory obligation to deliver first class post by the next day and second class post within 2 days.
But I mean, for ordinary people, this is going to be, I mean, it may be that you have to pay less to post your letters, but they're not going to notice any difference at the doorstep, are they?
I think most people would notice that over the past 10 years they've seen the price of stamps increase quite dramatically, and that's a direct result of the competition that's already been introduced into the marketplace. If you compare us to either the German or the Dutch model, they pay far more money for the service they receive, and the staff that work for those companies tend to be working on worse terms and conditions of employment, and there's less people employed in the industry.
So the Royal Mail has been part privatised already, Mike. Can you just tell us how that works? I mean, if you've got small companies, I mean, I know I've had stuff come through my door which doesn't have an ordinary Royal Mail stamp on it. It's got some sort of weird hexagram shape thing where the postage stamp should be and some kind of company's mark on there. What's going on? How does the Royal Mail manage to sort of survive in that sort of situation? Do companies pay Royal Mail a little bit to actually do the delivery end of the round? What I'm asking is, what state is it in now with this kind of some private businesses already in Royal Mail or in the postal service?
We went for a very difficult period of time in the last decade where our competitors were able to enter the marketplace and just do basically the first mile. They would do the bulk postings for people and they would deliver it into Royal Mail's system. We were obliged to offer them a rate of delivery that was 2 pence cheaper than what we were offering business to allow them to make a profit. They have set up initial sortation points, obviously paying their staff far less than Royal Mail employees are paid, using less staff on machines to make sure that they make a profit, and then dump their work directly onto our doorstep.
Yeah, but I mean, surely we're talking about, say, for example, Lloyds Bank. They send out all their statements maybe once a month to every single Lloyds Bank by post that wants to receive their bank statement by post. So that's like one lorry goes from Lloyds Bank up to Filton and then dumps it all there. I mean, that's a little bit unfair, isn't it? Because they're not doing a lot of work. It's just one lorry load.
It is completely unfair. We've always challenged the idea of downstream access. It's like anything where you push something out into the private sector, they will cherry pick the most profitable elements of it and leave the more expensive bits for a state provider. We have had some movement from the regulator recently where they've removed that headroom agreement because the regulator that was in place, Postcom, has been closed down and supervision for us now is dealt with by Ofcom. So we have lost that headroom issue, but we're still struggling to compete on that bottom end of the market. The real problem, I think, is that historically we used to use our bulk post in the cross-subsidised social mail, and that's why we managed to keep the price of social mail so low for so long in this country. But I'm sure most of your listeners will more than recognise the price of stamps gone through the roof in the last 10 years, and that's a direct result is from allowing big business to have massive discounts on their postal costs.
Now, in the Guardian this week, in fact, it was last weekend, in fact, it looks like the Observer on the 23rd, Royal Mail Chief is in line for almost £1.6 million pay for 1 year. Moira Green, the Chief Executive of Royal Mail, whose 2012 pay package is expected to be nearly £500,000 higher, well, she's done quite well, hasn't she? It's quite a big increase in her annual salary due to additional long-term incentive plans. The Royal Mail is steeling itself for a storm of protest, it says here, from the Communication Workers Union, following reports that the business is to reveal its chief executive was paid £1.6 million last year. The issue is sensitive because the union's at war with the management, it says here. Maybe you can tell us whether that's true or not, Mike. Over plans to privatise the business after a long period when many postal workers have lost their jobs. Last week, the CWU revealed more than 96% of postal workers who voted in a ballot opposed the sell-off, despite being promised about £1,500 in shares each as a part of a flotation plan. Now, that is incredible. So what the government is doing is it's saying you will actually get £1,500 in your pocket as Royal Mail shares if it's sold off, and that's almost like bribery.
Sounds a lot like it to me. I think most of our people recognise that there is no such thing as a free lunch, and money in your pocket today will come at a cost. And as we have seen over the past 10 years or so with some of the agreements that have come through Royal Mail, we've been put in a position where we have been losing some of the benefits that we enjoy in the long term, which obviously far outweigh any short-term incentives.
So what's Moira Green done to deserve her £500,000 50% pay rise this year?
Well, she's managed to steer Royal Mail to this point in time, at least, in a direction where there hasn't been major industrial unrest in the past sort of 3 or 4 years, and is turned the business around so it's made a headline figure of a £400 million profit.
Well, Royal Mail says Royal Mail has been transformed by Moira Green in the last 3 years. The business was loss-making and balance sheet insolvent. Now all our businesses are profitable and the UK is our strongest performer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, the irony here seems that the argument to sell off Royal Mail is that it's not making money, but now it is. And now they're saying because it is making money, it's a viable going concern and people will want to buy it.
That's the whole point. You can't sell loss-making businesses. It's one of the problems they had when they were trying to reform the communist system in the 1990s, which had quite a lot I used to work over there. And of course, you can't sell off things which aren't making a profit. So what they used to do is make them look as if they weren't making a profit, and then buy them up with cash or whatever. Or the other thing is you make them make a profit. But if you make things make a profit, then why would you want to privatise it? If it's making a profit for Britain, why don't we keep it?
Mike, what is the argument?
Well, the argument is a straightforward dash for cash. We have a government that is strapped in its finances. It's looking to squeeze money out of anybody's pocket. Obviously, depending on your earnings, but they're looking to plug a hole in what they perceive as a deficit in the budget in this country, and Royal Mail sell-off is just part of that.
Martin, is that the case? Do you think this is just a way to try and raise some money from a state asset?
Yeah, it is, but it's also ideological. They want to try and destroy the Royal Mail, as the name suggests, goes back hundreds of years. And of course, do you remember in the 90s when they changed the name to Consignia, was it? I mean, they spent millions on that. And of course, then realised actually Royal Mail really is. That's like, Chateau Lafitte 69 or whatever. You don't change that name because that's what the Royal Mail represents. But I mean, they want to break all that and destroy it. They're trying to wipe out history.
Okay, well, on to another one of the big stories this week, away from Royal Mail now, and to look at the incredible programme which was on Monday, Dispatches programme about police infiltration of the Stephen Lawrence's friends and family at the time after his murder. The whole thing began really a little bit earlier on the Monday with Theresa May making a speech, and you'll hear her now, followed by her Labour shadow Home Affairs spokesperson Yvette Cooper.
Undercover operations are a vital part of protecting the public. but it needs very detailed supervision, and undercover operations need constant reassessment to ensure that what is being done is justified. For obvious reasons, members of the public cannot know the details of the police's undercover operations, but we need to have the assurance that this work is conducted properly in accordance with a procedure that ensures that ethical lines are respected.
These latest allegations must be taken very seriously because they suggest that the full information was not given to the McPherson Review at the time, a concern which we raised last year in the House over corruption allegations where still we have no answers. And most disturbingly of all, they suggest that police officers were working undercover to undermine victims of crime when the very job of the police officer is to support and get justice for victims of crime.
Now, this has caused a bit of a political storm this week, Mike, but still no promise from the government that there's going to be a public inquiry, which is the sort of thing you would expect to expose the criminality that seems to have gone on here, particularly within the police. Lying, for example, to McPherson, refusing to reveal details of these covert operations to the official inquiry, and since finding out that these things were going on. And also we heard almost for the first thing that Theresa May said there was that the public can't expect to know the detail of these kinds of operations.
Well, I think this is becoming a shockingly familiar narrative to as we reflect on history and we look back at what's happening in quite recent times. The level of police interference in normal day-to-day living, it is quite surprising.
The most shocking thing, I think, maybe about all this is the idea of actually smearing key witnesses in the, potentially anyway, in the Lawrence case, in the murder case. Somebody who was with Stephen Lawrence the night he was murdered was then the police actively went in to find information that they could use to smear him as a witness. Now, surely that's perverting the course of justice, if at the very, very least, for the police not to reveal that. I mean, you know, you have to ask yourself, what is going on at the Metropolitan Police when they seem to be actually completely losing any idea of what's right and what's wrong?
Well, I was quite interested to hear Theresa May say that she believed that these things were being carried out in an ethical manner. I mean, there seems to be a distinct political bias to what is actually going on.
Okay, before we hear from Martin, let's hear from the House of Commons again, back on Monday, and this is Diane Abbott, the London Labour MP, who was the first person to actually raise the Stephen Lawrence case in the House of Commons many years ago.
And I was close to the Lawrence family at the time, and I remember the reason Doreen was so angry, was so upset and was so determined was she felt that the police weren't even trying. Now it seems clear that not only were they not trying, they were actively trying to denigrate and smear the family. Does the Home Secretary appreciate that this was a totemic case for a generation, and she owes it to the Lawrence family, but she also owes it to the wider community to get to the bottom of what happened and who knew and who authorised this operation?
Well, I think one of the things that people forget about this case, and I remember at the time, is that the word on the street was that the lads who actually carried out the attack thought they could get away with it because their families were big criminals in South London, and that they got various coppers on the payroll. So we're not just talking about institutional racism here, we're possibly talking about corruption, which might give the motive for people to try and smear the defence campaign for Stephen Lawrence. And of course, on a wider perspective, we're also hearing about all these women who've been given babies by the police. Did that used to go on in East Germany? I wonder. I mean, there's a real question here, is, was that rape? And are those people then responsible for basically for rape, effectively, and you know, fairly serious? I mean, what we should be looking for is not really inquiries here; it's prosecutions of senior officers and imprisonments.
Well, that can come through a public inquiry, but it certainly won't come through an internal police inquiry, because there's just no confidence that the police are actually capable of investigating the police, certainly not in London. Anyway, let's go back now to the actual dispatches programme itself on Monday evening. It was called The Police's Dirty Secret, and here's Peter Francis, the undercover policeman, and he's talking about the whole situation with Dwayne Brooks, who was Stephen Lawrence's friend, who was then later smeared by the police.
Just a month after Stephen's death, an anti-racist demonstration outside South East London BNP headquarters turned violent. Peter Francis picked up intelligence that Dwayne Brooks may have been involved. He reported the information back to his superiors and was asked to dig further.
Myself and another STS officer went through the material we had, the media we had, and between us we'd identified him participating in some criminality, perceived criminality. This then was sent through the same chain of command, Special Branch DI, DCI, out to division again, and the decision was obviously made to go and arrest Dwayne for said offences.
Did they seem pleased that you'd found
out? Yes, they did seem pleased that we'd found out. I think also it provided probably the first in ever in the Stephen Lawrence campaign. This is a clear whiter than white campaign, can't be tarnished, the public's all behind it. All of a sudden, Stephen Lawrence's friend was actually a violent activist.
A month after Peter says he placed Dwayne Brooks at the demonstration, Dwayne was charged with criminal damage and violent disorder. The case was dismissed as an abuse of process.
The case was dismissed as an abuse of process, Martin, so it never actually came to a conviction for Dwayne Brooks. Now, this really is appalling. This is malicious falsehood. They're piling one thing on another, it seems, the Met at this stage, the special branch in the Metropolitan Police and this the demonstration squad. It clearly seems that the police believed that they would never be found out, that there would be complete impunity for them, even if they were committing criminal acts.
They did, and I think that's why I say we're not really interested in inquiries, we want to see prosecutions. And of course that's what we'd be demanded in Northern Ireland. And if we take the clock back a few years, people would say we want to see prosecutions or there's going to be executions. Now that's how serious this stuff is, and we can't afford to be weak about it. If people have been involved in criminal activity, for example ordering people to give people babies, that is rape. Those people should be in prison, that is all.
But it's all very well to say that, but who is going to do a prosecution? The police. And of course,
the
Lawrence family don't have confidence in the police investigating themselves.
Well, maybe the PSNI should be brought in, eh? Let's bring the boys over from Belfast.
Mike, what's your thoughts about this particular bit of interference in the court case by actually smearing wrongly, as it seems, finally, because he was cleared in court, the key witness at the Stephen Lawrence murder trial?
Well, it's quite clear from the evidence it appears to be presented to us. The police have overstepped the boundaries of their responsibilities. There is a clear demarcation line. They are there to investigate crime, not to set a narrative for how they behave or what's happening in society.
Well, as the week rolled on, this also was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions, not by Ed Miliband. He found something more important. I don't know what it was, but we may hear later what it was that was more important to bring up. And it was brought up by the Labour MP, David Winnick.
In congratulating the Honourable Gentleman on his birthday, I call Mr. David Winnick.
I certainly wouldn't suggest a vote on it, Mr. Speaker. Is the Prime Minister aware how shocking it was? But the police apparently spent more time investigating the parents and friends of Stephen Lawrence than the racist murder itself, which took place in 1993. Is the Home Secretary, when she meets Mrs. Lawrence, is she going to apologise for what occurred? And is it really right for the police to investigate itself?
I think the Honourable Gentleman makes an extremely serious point. This is a very, very serious situation. The Lawrence family have suffered appallingly. They lost their son. There was the failure to investigate properly for year after year, and now they hear these allegations that the police were trying to undermine them rather than help them. Now, my Honourable Friend, the Right Honourable Friend, the Home Secretary, set out in the House on Monday these two inquiries, independent inquiries, already underway. She's met again with Mark Ellison, Allison QC this morning to make sure his inquiry will cover the allegations that were made overnight about the bugging by the police of a friend of Stephen Lawrence. But I have to say, nothing is off the table. If more needs to be done, if further investigations or inquiries need to be held, they will be held. This is not an acceptable situation. We must get to the bottom of it.
Well, that's the Prime Minister there saying nothing is off the table, but is a public inquiry on the table? The reason being that we've actually, Martin, haven't we, had some quite big changes in the way that public inquiries operate. The Inquiries Act 2005 led to the sort of inquiry that we saw with Leveson. Before that, you'd have a judge, what they're calling now, they call it a judge-led inquiry. Before that, a public inquiry was actually run by a judge, but it was able to subpoena witnesses, and also there were usually some form of prosecution would almost immediately result from that. So it was a very much more formal process in the old days, but it's changed now, the public inquiry, hasn't it?
It has, and if the Pat Finucane Centre in Belfast have said that they've and various other similar organisations have been calling for inquiries into Pat Finucane's assassination, but also many other untoward actions that took place during the Troubles, but they won't. They're not interested in a British public inquiry, precisely for the reason you've just put forward, that it's basically British public inquiries were never completely more than a whitewash, but they now pretty much are a whitewash, so that they're demanding an international inquiry into what went on in the Troubles, which will have British people on it, but it's not going to be a British inquiry.
Well, it was interesting watching Leveson. It seemed to me more like some sort of media circus, because it was televised and all that kind of thing. I mean, well, you know, we do like the idea generally, don't we, of actually seeing into our courts, because, I mean, although you're not supposed to now, I mean, it's illegal, in fact, to film in courts and record in courts, but it means that justice is seen to be done. But the way that Leveson inquiry was arranged, it did almost seem as if it was made for TV. The old-fashioned public inquiry wasn't quite like that. Is there anything you'd like to add, Mike, about what you'd like to see happen now?
Well, the important thing is that we have transparency. The important thing is that we don't give the opportunity for people to plan behind the scenes and create a narrative for themselves. At the end of the day, we've got to call public officials to account on this.
But the thing is, these police officers involved in this, the ones actually making the decisions approving these operations, clearly thought they were above the law.
Well, that is a challenge that has to be met, isn't it? At the end of the day, we have to deal with this as an issue. It's been flagged up. We need a proper inquiry to establish what the issues are, and prosecutions have to flow from that, if obviously appropriate on the evidence.
Martin, I think it was Paul Condon who was in charge of the Met at the time. Surely this would have been, this sort of operation would have been approved right the way up to the top.
Well, he says not. That means that somebody...
No, he says he doesn't remember.
Oh, well, we'll find out then, won't we, in due course. Now,
this is what we got at Leveson as well, isn't it? Do you remember? We got everyone at Leveson turning up saying, I don't remember, I don't recall.
Also, we got William Hague turning up the other day saying that the security services in Britain are under legal control. Now, either A, he doesn't know what he's talking about, because basically they've told him they were under legal control, but they're not, or he does know and he's lying, because basically it goes that far up. Now, in actual fact, both the police and the intelligence services in this country are in fact suspects in a lot of very dubious things, including many terrorist attacks here and elsewhere, and we've got to clean this up.
Well,
the
other important ingredient of a old-fashioned pre-2005 public inquiry was a jury. This is another aspect to it. I mean, one of the things they did, for example, with the 7/7 London bombings is they had an inquest. They didn't have a public inquiry. The inquest was a sort of parallel inquest for lots of different people. Although an inquest is designed for just one suspicious death, a public inquiry is much better. Is much better at looking at lots and lots of different aspects of evidence around a particular controversial happening. Anyway, on a related subject, our local chief constable Nick Gargan was on the radio this week. And he was discussing a report by G4S. You remember them from the Olympics last year? One of the biggest companies in the world, private security firm. And they have issued their own report, a glowing report, on how well they've been doing in Lincolnshire, working with Lincolnshire Constabulary to part privatise them. Anyway, let's see what our local Chief Constable Nick Gargan had to say about that.
We in Avon and Somerset Constabulary have a very successful deal with IBM as part of a South West One partnership, and several forces up and down the country have been saving money for years by outsourcing their custody facility. So the G4S deal in Lincolnshire is striking because it involved such a high proportion of their staff, but it's not entirely novel. And indeed, the claim that forces could save £1 billion by rolling out what's happened in Lincolnshire is, I think, a slightly dubious claim because it assumes that everybody hasn't outsourced already and that everyone's in the same starting position of Lincolnshire, which is simply not the case. Think that G4S of all people should be careful about extrapolating one small bit of business and kind of overstretching themselves. They had some difficulty last year when they overstretched themselves in respect of the Olympics, and I think this claim that policing could save £1 billion by doing what Lincolnshire's done is a slightly ambitious one. But nevertheless, on the face of it, the deal with Lincolnshire is a very good one. They're putting extra officers on the streets, or rather they're not having to take officers away from the streets to the extent that they otherwise would have done, and I think it shows the sort of creativity that chief constables have been demonstrating up and down the country in response to the challenges of the spending review.
Mike Wilcott, what are your thoughts about that claim there that G4S are making, that the nation could save £1 billion annually by privatising the police and letting G4S run it?
Well, I mean, the unfortunate situation you find is you lose even more democratic control over that organisation. It's you end up with a race to the bottom, and you end up with people being paid the minimum wage for carrying out some really quite serious and dangerous tasks in society.
That's right, and of course the other thing that people have got to remember is G4S doesn't have the security clearance that the police have got. You were talking earlier about Royal Mail. Once you privatise, you've got to actually check all of those people properly. If they're involved in security, like if I was a bank robber and I wanted to escape and I was being taken somewhere by G4S, I'd have a word with the G4S lads and pay them a few bob, and then they'd let me run away, wouldn't they?
Well, maybe one of the reasons that G4S can do this so cheaply is that they don't need to go through all these paperwork.
Well, exactly.
This red tape.
Mm. And that red tape is the security aspects of the business, isn't it?
Okay, well, back to Westminster and Prime Minister's questions. We had the Prime Minister, David Cameron, was actually asking questions of Ed Miliband, which I find rather bizarre. It's supposed to be Prime Minister's questions, not Leader of the Opposition's questions. But let's see how they got on.
Let me ask him again the question he won't answer. Will he? Well, I know he doesn't want to answer the question, but that's why, I have to say, Mr. Speaker, that is why half the country think that he's Bert from the Muppets, because they think he belongs in Sesame Street, not Downing Street. No, let me give him another go. Will you admit borrowing would go up under Labour?
Mr. Speaker, let me say to him, we'll swap places any time.
Here is the reality. The Prime Minister promised to balance the books, but borrowing was up last year. He said we're all in it together, but living standards are falling. He promised to get Britain building. They haven't. All you need to know about this Chancellor's spending review is the British people are paying the price for their failure.
Well, I have to say, I don't have to say anything, but I will. It's the whole idea of question time seems to have gone out the window with Speaker Bercow, Mike. He doesn't actually get Cameron to answer the question, so quite often David Cameron just simply avoids answering the question. And now we've got the situation there this week where the questions aren't being answered, but questions are being asked of the Leader of the Opposition by the Prime Minister. And the whole thing seems to be slowly falling apart as any kind of meaningful democratic exercise.
I have grave reservations over the way this has become a version of the Jeremy Kyle show. It's self-promotion by people who haven't got serious things to say about the efforts that they're making to try and bring the country round, and to hide behind accusations in the opposition of they wouldn't do this or they wouldn't do that. It's just a smokescreen to detract from the fact that they should be answering the questions. They should be being honest about the damage that they're causing to our country.
I must say, Martin, I'm coming round to your point of view that this is a bit of a waste of time when you don't actually get answers. I mean, some of the questions are being answered, but quite a lot of the time it just seems to be, you know, making silly jokes about the Muppets and Sesame Street. I mean, this isn't the way to run the country.
Yeah, I remember watching the Polish Parliament operate when I was over there, used to live over there, and it's boring. It's like watching paint drying. But the idea that all this Yaboo sucks, you're an idiot stuff is normal. Well, it's normal in Britain, but it ain't normal in other parts of Northern Europe.
Well, it certainly hasn't been in the past. If you look back back historically, different speakers have conducted things in different manners, have not let, for example, prime ministers get away with just blustering and not answering a question. They pinned them down. In fact, last week on this show, we had one of the questions where Burko did actually pull Cameron up, saying, you know, if you're not going to answer the question, we'll move on. Anyway, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, this is really looking at the spending review, which happened, George Osborne gave just after Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. The IFS's analysis of the spending review highlights a shortfall in tax, and this was in The Guardian on Thursday. Britain's public services face the most severe spending cuts in 60 years. It will look radically different at the end of the decade, a leading think tank warned on Thursday. That's the IFS. Many services will have disappeared, others will be transformed following a cut of 30% or more as the government presses ahead with its radical cost-cutting policy across Whitehall and local government, according to the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Such is the scale of planned budget cuts. The next government will be forced to make big reductions in welfare spending or raise taxes to save some departments from providing all but the most basic services. IFS Director Paul Johnson said in a minimum of $6 billion tax rise was on the cards after the general election, whichever party wins power, to address a $25 billion deficit in the government's accounts between 2016 and 2018. At some point, we're going to have a serious debate about all the rest of the fiscal consolidation is actually going to happen through spending cuts alone. It seems that, Martin, that this is one thing that Osborne is wedded to entirely, is that cuts are going to deliver, but they don't really seem to be, do they?
No, they don't. And of course, what happens is, as you cut, the deficit gets worse. Let's just repeat that. We've been saying it on this programme umpteen times over the last 3 years. As you cut, the deficit gets worse, because that's A-level economics, George. And so, of course, therefore, you've got to cut more because the deficit's not under control. Now, this, of course, is madness. And unfortunately, I'm afraid the Labour leadership are being drawn into this madness because everybody just presumes that the economy is stagnant. What will happen now, as we saw last week when Bernanke suggested that he might start reining in QE, there was just about a crash. And he said, no, I didn't mean that. So possibly, before we have the next election in this country, we're going to have a stock market crash all over the world. And then we won't be arguing about how we're going to cut the deficit by cutting public expenditure. Everybody will be having a screaming, nervous breakdown.
Mike, I suppose I should ask you, why is it that the Labour leadership is really going along? I mean, we had Mark Steele on BBC Question Time last night joking that the Labour Party leadership is actually just copying Conservative policies nowadays. There doesn't really seem to be any kind of alternative being put forward by them.
Policy development isn't a process of being done. Nobody really saw the 2008 crash coming, and people have been firefighting ever since.
Well, the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, who we'll be talking about after the news, they certainly did, and there were several others. Martin, for example, is on YouTube way back talking about that before it happened. But anyhow, yeah, carry on. Sorry, interrupting you there.
You call me that. The reality of the situation is that the Labour Party is in a position where it has to develop policy in reaction to where we are and not to where we should be.
But shouldn't the leaders be doing that right now? I mean, shouldn't they have been doing it 3 or 4 years ago?
You could say that of all political organisations, but at the end of the day, we need to be developing a robust set of policies that gets this country working again and gets people off the dole queues.
Can I just say, I mean, I understand the dilemma that they are in, because what's sayable in this situation is everybody presumes, the mainstream, the ordinary punters presume, and the mainstream commentators presume, that we are just going to probably, either the right thinks the economy is going to pick up, I think that's hopeless. The left just presumes that we're going to bumble along and we will be fighting on exactly the same turf we're on now in 15 months' time. But in actual fact, I don't think we will be on that turf in 15 months' time when the election comes, because of all the things that are in the pipeline. Now, it would be stupid for the Labour leadership to start screaming about how bad the situation is. That's not their job. They're there to calm everybody down with a sort of bedside manner. You are going to die.
Even if it's rubbish.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid that's the way of it, because they've actually got to win an election in the marginal constituencies around
London. But
won't
they get more respect from the voters if they actually call things as they are?
No, because the Labour Party is a great big organisation. There are people in it like me who regard capitalism as a basically failed system, and there are others who think it is salvageable. I think they're wrong, but they're going to find out by by trying to salvage it that they can't do it like that, and then things will move in the right direction. But the main thing we've got to do is stop the runaway train. The coalition have determined to double down on their own stupid policy errors. They've lost the country's credit rating, which is what they told us this was all for. I need to scream this from the rooftops. They said we're doing all this to keep the country's credit rating.
No, the good news,
you've lost it.
Martin, the good news this week, which you haven't addressed there, is that there was no double-dip recession. It looks as if actually what the economy was doing was it was sort of chugging along at an exact level. It wasn't going down and then up and then down again. It was level.
Yeah, but it's also what they've also said is in actual fact it's the fall from top to bottom was bigger than they thought, and we've lost far more GDP than they originally anticipated. This about double dip in any case is delusionary. A recession is defined in the textbook as two consecutive quarters of negative growth. And you know, they only use the word recession, that was invented in the 1950s, because they didn't want to use the much more horrid word which people used to use, which was depression. We're in a depression, not a double dip recession, a depression, just like the 1930s, except it's worse than the 1930s because the financial sector is far more out of control by a factor of enormous factor compared to the 30s.
So you would just borrow and spend, would you?
No, we will end up borrowing and spending anyway. And what will happen in the US is probably hyperinflation, because you can't control the situation. What they should have done when they came to power is not cut so fast, not cut so deeply, consolidate a bit, raise taxes on the wealthy, and you might just have kept the car on the road. They chose to put their foot to the floor, and their heads are about to go through the windscreen. All of our heads are about to go through the windscreen. And on the other side of that, we won't be talking about cutting public expenditure anymore.
Well, that's not going to happen, Martin, is it? Because what's actually really going to happen is slowly but surely the public sector is going to be shrunk and shrunk until it's virtually nothing.
They presume that they can manage this process. The cuts in the public sector will lead to cuts through the multiplier effect in spending in the economy, which means the deficit will get worse as all these 144,000 public sector workers are kicked out of their jobs. That is not going to solve the deficit problem. Nothing, you're never going to solve it like that. Ultimately, you've got to go back to tax rates like they had in the 1950s of 90-odd% in America and in Britain, because if you're rebuilding your country after a major crash and a world war, that's what you've got to do.
Nobody's going to pay that. They're all going to put the money in the Cayman Islands, aren't they?
Well, that's what they can do now, unless we do something about it. But throughout the Thatcher era, when everybody in the Tory party thought things were rosy in the garden, load of rubbish from my point of view, the top rate of tax was 85% throughout most of the era. The sky didn't fall, did it?
Okay, Dave, what are your thoughts about what should be done now? If it's not necessarily cutting, I mean, would you think that cuts need to happen still?
I think there's a need for investment. At the end of the day, we have a massive housing shortage in this country. Okay, we have unemployment, an unhealthy level. And we need to get people back to work. We need to be producing things for ordinary people in this country, not expensive items and designer goods, but goods that people actually require. People need a home to live. We have 14,000 people on a waiting list for social housing in this city, and we built 12 houses last year. It's an absolutely shameful situation, and the situation's compounded by the high private rents that are being charged to those people who are currently having to rent from the private sector and pay somebody's mortgage effectively because they can't afford to get a mortgage of their own.
Well, Danny Alexander this week has announced a £3.3 billion affordable homes package to deliver 165,000 new homes. So it sounds like the Liberal Democrats are delivering exactly what you want.
It's a drop in the ocean compared to what's actually needed.
That's absolutely right. Ultimately, there's going to have to be a massive crash investment of public investment. So how are you going to fund that? Well, partly we'll fund it on borrowing. The government is going to end up borrowing far more than they imagined, because that's what happens in a depression. They think that they can get the deficit down by cutting. They can't. That will become, eventually people will wake up to how stupid that is. And in actual fact, we need massive investment. And that really means rebuilding the tax base. At the end of World War II, we had a proper tax base. The wealthy classes were just told to shut up and get their checkbooks out. Everybody needs a house. We're going to have to do that again. And Labour will have to find the courage to demand these things as well. But also, of course, we've got to be responsible, respectable, and all the rest of it. I do understand that. I feel the dilemma that they are in. But we're actually talking about in this stupid way because of all the stupid stuff that's been done over the last 30 years.
Now, another news story this week. HSBC has cut its Mediterranean private bank team after a drug ring investigation. And this is in Zurich. HSBC's private bank in Switzerland is dramatically cutting its North Africa and Israeli teams after a former employee was convicted of laundering money for the Moroccan drug dealers. Sources close to the bank said the Mediterranean and Israeli business, known as Media, had managed up to $8 billion, that's £5.2 billion, and had between 12 and 15 staff. We've restructured the business dramatically. It will see the majority of clients leave, HSBC spokesman Medard Schoenemaker said. He declined to say how many staff would remain. Martin, this is HSBC have been convicted in the United States for this money laundering. It now seems that there's another branch of them in Switzerland which has also been involved in money laundering. And rather than people going to jail, it's simply saying, oh, well, we'll close that down.
Yes, of course, that's quite right. I mean, the law is not being enforced. They should be in prison. If we're going to send street drug dealers in Bristol to prison, why aren't these people being sent to prison? But the other point is that during 2009, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime produced a report, which is basically done by lots of police officers all over the world, and it concluded that what happened during the banking crisis in 2008 is all the dirty money in the world was sucked into the banking system in one big flow, sucking sound. So in actual fact, the banking system, the financial markets are being propped up, A, by the taxpayer, B, by the drug cartels. That is not an exaggeration. That's the situation. And we are not in a normal situation where the economy is going to gradually recover and we can argue about whether we're going to spend a little bit more, a little bit less on that or this or that or the other. The banking system is absolutely bust and run by criminals. That's the facts.
Mike, what's your thoughts on what's happening with HSBC there? Because most people would expect, I mean, for example, if you want to open a bank account, you've got to go through this massive disclosure process about everything to do with your utility bills, loads of your history, your passport, in order to check to see that you're not a money launderer. But when HSBC, the bank, actually is caught laundering money, it looks like in Switzerland, to do with Switzerland and Israel and in the Mediterranean, that they're just told, naughty boys, and you're going to have to close that branch down.
In a pursuit of profit, morality goes out of the window, and I mean it is a shameful indictment of the ideology that supports the free market at the moment.
Well, the strange thing is, of course, that HSBC are actually doing incredibly well at the moment, and there may be people out there thinking, well, if these guys can get away with it, maybe that's where I should be putting my money. We heard last week about the co-op in bank in all sorts of trouble, an ethical bank in all sorts of trouble, and someone from HSBC actually moving in to become their chief executive.
Well, that's the problem, you see. If you don't nip this kind of thing in the bud, then everybody else has got to be bent as well, otherwise they lose on the bottom line, and so the whole system becomes corrupted by steps. They ought to try and break these banks up. They ought to investigate the leadership. Many of them ought to be in prison. That's what happened in the 1930s, frankly. A lot of people were sent to prison. That's what happened in the 1980s in the US. It hasn't happened this time because their political power is too great. And, of course, the fear is that if they were really to go in hard and try and sort them out, they would collapse anyway. And when you say HSBC is making a profit, that is, if you don't look at the books, they're cooking the books. They're carrying masses and masses of toxic debt on the books, which are marked to magic rather than marked to market. If they had to sell that stuff on the market, it would be worth zilch. But it's marked on their books as being worth what they say it's worth. And that's why they're able to make a profit, which allows the shareholders and the executives to make bonuses. But in actual fact, there is no real
profit.
But
why shouldn't people just put their money in HSBC thinking, well, these are the super crooks, they can get away with it? So they seem to be the guys to go with.
Well, that's basically what happens, and that's why they get away with it, and that's why the bubble carries on extending. Although, as I said earlier, when Ben Bernanke hinted last week that they might stop quantitative easing, there was an immediate kind of heart tremor, you know, one of those minor warning heart attacks.
Mike, would you put your money into... Have you got a bank account with HSBC?
No, I'm afraid I haven't, actually. It's not somewhere where I would look to invest. I like to invest my money in an ethical institution.
OK, spending on the monarchy is up by £900,000 this year to £33.3 million. This is the BBC. Government spending on the monarchy rose by £1 million this year. The Queen's official expenditure increased by £900,000 in 2012-13 compared to the previous 12 months. Alan Reid, keeper of the Privy Purse, said the figure was a real terms reduction. the grant paid to the monarchy is calculated at 15% of the money paid by the Crown Estate to the government. The estate, which includes property across the UK, increased its profits by 5% to £252.6 million in 2012-13. Martin, that was, someone's done quite nicely out of all this, haven't they? This is the Queen, and she's got an extra, nearly an extra million this year.
Well, I think this is really, I mean, this is politically inept by the monarchy at a moment when everybody else is being, you know, wages are being cut and people are losing their jobs. To have a pay increase for the monarchy doesn't look good. But in actual fact, the amounts of money involved compared to HSBC, which you were talking about a minute ago, are minuscule. So there's it's more a presentational thing. The monarchy is very unwise to be having pay increases at a moment like this. Silly of them.
Mike, former Royal Mail, Royal. So I don't know if there's any connection between the two at all. Royal staff costs rose from £17.5 million to £18.3 million, while the cost of maintaining royal buildings increased by £200,000 to £9.1 million. The most expensive royal trip was the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge's Diamond Jubilee Tour of Southeast Asia and the South Pacific, which cost £370,000, including a planning visit in advance by staff. And I remember reading in another article that the one use of the royal train in that fiscal year cost £30,000. I mean, we're getting value for money?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. I think it's quite obscene at a time when public sector workers are having to suffer a pay freeze. We've seen a 21% increase over the past 2 years in the spending on the monarchy, who should really be in a financial position to look after themselves.
Well, ultimately, though, surely they're actually quite good for the country.
Historically, they are, maybe, but I don't think many of our visitors to the shores of this country actually see the Queen. I think this that's a bit of a misnomer, really.
For those of you who enjoyed dispatches this week on Channel 4, it is at 8 o'clock on Mondays. There is another dispatches coming on next Monday. They seem to be on a bit of a roll at the moment, called The Prince and His Secret Properties. Definitely one to keep an eye open for. In 2012, Prince Charles earned more than £18 million from the Duchy of Cornwall, but how much do we know about the secretive estate? The Channel 4 dispatches investigation reveals the scale of its hugely profitable property empire and looks at the amount that Prince Charles is paying as the heir to the throne. He inherited the Duchy of Cornwall, a vast array of farming, residential and commercial land and properties, as well as a multi-million pound financial investment portfolio. With the tax arrangements of wealthy individuals and major corporations making headline news, these dispatches findings come as Parliament's Public Accounts Committee prepares to launch its own inquiry into why, unlike other commercial businesses, the Duchy does not pay corporation tax nor capital gains tax. Martin.
Yeah, I think these anomalies are becoming clear, aren't they? If we're going to have a monarchy which does work, I mean, you know, they go on these foreign trips, but they are in fact working, okay, I accept that, then we'll pay for all of that. But in that case, we're going to take all the rest of it off you, because that actually belongs to the state. The Duchy of Cornwall is actually the state. That's us. That belongs to us, Charles, and not to you. And you are going to be, if we're going to keep a monarchy, you are going to be employees, and that's all.
Well, I have to agree with that opinion. I think we are living in a time when we are seeing two versions of an economy where a certain sector is doing very, very well and living life to the full, and the rest of us, the vast majority of people, ordinary people on the streets, are having to pull in their belts. I'm particularly shocked by the whole trajectory that this country is going on at the moment.
And what are you going to do about it, Mike?
I will campaign within the Labour Party, within the trade union movement, for us to try to get a greater level of social equality in society.
Well, thanks very much to this week's guest. That was Labour Councillor for Brislington East, Mike Woollacott. After the news, King Mervyn's retiring and a new kid's moving on to the block at the City of London.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a 5-year-old boy is being treated for facial injuries after being mauled by a dog at a primary school playground.